So good afternoon. And I'll be talking about freedom with thoughts, which I know you're all very experienced with these last couple of days. So Muslim Nasruddin was a 13th century wise man, a Sufi wise man, and he was a bit of a combination of a wise man and a fool. And so there's a little story of his. You know, a man came to Nasruddin asking for his help. He said, "I live in this little tiny house with, you know, my, you know, wife and three kids, and my in-laws just moved in, and, you know, everybody's arguing and everybody's upset, and, you know, what do I do?" So, Nasruddin thought about it and said, "Well, you know, go out and buy some, you know, buy a few chickens and bring them into the house." You know, and he kind of looks puzzled, but, you know, it's the wise man speaking, so he does it. And he comes back the next day, you know, he says, "Oh, it's even worse. It's even worse." You know, so he says, "Okay, go ahead and bring in a goat into the house." You know, and of course he does the same thing, you know, brings it, you know, brings it home, and, you know, things are really getting bad. And, you know, comes back one time now, you know, he's pretty upset, and he says, "Oh no, what should I do?" He says, "Okay, now bring a donkey in." And of course now he does it anyways. You know, he's just like, "Okay, I'll do whatever you tell me. I'm so desperate." And so he does it. And then he comes back the next day. He's just distraught. It's just, oh, things are so bad. So Nasruddin says, "Okay, now go home, sell the goat, the donkey, the chickens, and come back and see me tomorrow." And, you know, he comes back the next day. He says, "Oh, everything's great. Everybody's happy." So, you know, this is a little bit how our minds are. So I want to point a little bit to the difference between our felt experience and the story we tell about it. Now, when I say that, you know, sometimes, you know, people think that the stories are somehow wrong. But we really don't mean it that way. But there's just really knowing the difference between what's the felt experience of something. You know, for instance, you know, you feel your breath, you know, you might feel the tingling, you feel all these little different sensations. And then part of your mind is telling a story about them, right? And saying, "Boy, that's a really smooth breath." You know, or "That breath isn't quite right. I need to breathe deeper." Or, you know, the little narrator in the back of our minds that does that. And so it's really beginning to really see that difference between those two. Sometimes in meditation, those get confused. We think that the story is what's actually the felt sense. So what I wanted to talk about you know, Daniel Kahneman. He was a psychologist who won the Nobel Prize, and he was studying happiness. And he said one of the inherent problems is that we have two different parts of the self. One of them is the experiencing self, and one of them is the remembering self. And this is a little bit what we're talking about in this meditation practice, really. You know, so one self experiences everything, and the other one remembers what happened. And the way that, for instance, an example, you know, the experiencing self lives in the present, experiences the warmth of the room, you know, the affection between two people, you know, the lighting, you know, the experiencing self is listening to this talk right now. So that's the experiencing self. And the remembering self is the one that at the end of the talk will say, "Oh, I was really tired during that talk," or you know, "She was talking way too loud." you know, so the different evaluations we might make, you know, that's the remembering self. And, you know, most of us cannot remember, and now tell me if it's otherwise for you, but can't remember the details of your last sitting. How many of the many, many moments do you remember? But if someone asked you, what was your last sitting like, you'd come up with something, right? So it's a story, you know, and how accurate is that story? That's really an interesting question, you know. And in researching happiness, they found that the difference between our enjoyment, moment-to-moment enjoyment, and how we remember it is very different. They don't jive. And a good example is there was like this this man who went to this beautiful concert, you know, beautiful concert, and the first 20 minutes were exquisite. They were just exquisite, and you know, he was like totally into it. And then loud screeching sound, you know, violin broke, and when he was asked about the concert, it was a terrible concert, right? Because that's what we remember. We tend to remember the ends of the stories, the conclusions of the stories, but not necessarily the moments of the stories. You know, one way of saying it is the remembering self keeps score. You know, it maintains the narrative of our lives, which is useful. You know, we need that narrative. You know, the narrative is an important part of understanding our lives, communicating with people, and living in this world. So that's why perhaps the story of, you know, Nusrat-Din was that the man who, you know, sold his goats and animals, you know, he remembered the ending of his story, right? He didn't remember all the misery that came before. You know, in fact, everything in that story before that was miserable, 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 but boy, he had a happy ending. That's what he remembers, you know, and that's how we are, you know. And in a way, that's part of what this practice does, is it brings those two closer together. As the mindfulness becomes stronger and stronger, the stories that we see become more and more accurate and more useful. You know, for instance, the idea in my mind was that a good meditation was staying on my breath the whole time and being at least peaceful and comfortable, you know, and that was a good meditation, you know. And so I had a meditation where I had a really deep insight of something, but then it ended with like, oh, my back really hurts, you know, so my mind evaluates bad meditation, you know. So what we're doing is in the practice is like becoming aware enough of our stories that we make our stories useful to us, that we make them helpful to us. How many of the stories do we tell ourselves? Oh, I'm not good enough. I'm too critical. I can't do this. Or I'm smarter than everyone else. Or, you know, all the different little stories we tell ourselves. And so the idea is to, you know, not just to, okay, put the stories aside for now, but to just really, when they show up, oh, that story's not very, very helpful. Let's, you know, let's not feed it anymore. Let's change it to a better story. You know, we like being calm. Most of us love being calm. You know, we, and it's really easy to put the thinking process outside, you know, outside of meditation in our minds. Even when we know better, I mean, I was practicing for at least a year or so before I finally said, okay, I'm not going to reject thoughts anymore. You know, for me, if thoughts arose, they were wrong for being there, you know, and I heard the Dharma talks, I heard everything, but I didn't believe that they were okay to be there. You know, so anytime there was a lot of thoughts going on, I would just, kind of be a little dour, you know, that they were going on. And it took me a long time to really begin to understand that the friendliness towards our thinking process was needed, that was more important than having a mind with no thoughts. You know, that the practice is about having a wholesome state of mind, having the quality of our mind be happy, not about what the contents of the mind are. And that's a little bit of how we've been teaching this retreat, is that, you know, these are objects that show up. You know, we have sensations, we have emotions, we have thoughts, and these are the different things, you know, that show up, the things from the senses, the memories, all these contents show up. And the idea is not to have some content and not other content, but it's to have it be in a wholesome environment, and then we can just see it come and go. It all comes and goes away. But it's also very helpful to steer our thoughts in a useful direction. You know, an example is that if we're used to all the time looking for what's wrong with people, one of my favorite hobbies as a teenager was, you know, me and my friends would get together and you know, gossip about what was wrong with everyone we knew. And, you know, some people had different upbringings, but that was, you know, unfortunately that was where I hung out then. And, you know, so it gets really strong. I was really good at noticing, you know, what was wrong with everyone. And that's what I kept seeing, you know. And it was very hard for me to see what was good with people because my mind was so geared that way, you know. And I would, you know, kind of see them by this stereotype of whatever was the fault I deemed in them. And, you know, and it's something that I actually took time to train myself away from. Because even though, you know, I grew out of my teenage immaturity, the tendency to see what's wrong with people stayed with me through adulthood. And it was only once I started really practicing that I could see that, you know, the teacher would come up here and, oh, look at the way he's leaning to the left, you know. I mean, how good a meditator can he be if he's leaning to the left, you know? especially, it was kind of funny, you know, at this long retreat, you know, the teacher was talking about how he used to lean to the left, and how somebody, and how he was totally unaware of it, and somebody corrected him, and how, you know, how it was amazing how he couldn't tell, and he still couldn't tell. but it didn't matter, you know, he was an amazing teacher, you know, so... So the practice I took on was, and I've told this before, but if you haven't heard me, I learned from somebody else. I got the idea from someone, from another teacher, and it was, I went to this, to an airport. I was at the airport. I didn't go there on purpose, but I was there. And the idea was to look at everybody I saw and find something I liked about them. Every single person, you know, and I don't remember how long I did this for, but, you know, some people was like, oh, look at that, you know, this guy's carrying a guitar, how cool, you know, it's like, I bet he has nice music, you know, really, really nice and easy, and oh, look at that beautiful smile, really nice and easy, you know, and oh, they've got nice hair, you know, so I just kept looking and looking, and then this woman came in with her, like, four-year-old, and she was like, kind of dragging him, you know, just kind of yanking on his arm. And I immediately, all this hatred arose in me, you know, it was like, okay, this is an exercise, you know, and I don't have to save the kid. He's actually okay. He's just, you know, not being treated nicely. I finally, you know, looking for something, so anything I could find to like here. And she had these little rainbow socks, you know, and it was like, oh, those are cute, you know. but it was, you know, that training of the mind to look, you know, and then that kind of grew from there, you know. So I finally just started seeing more of the good, and the part of me that saw what was wrong with people made me a great volunteer director. You know, it gave me, it actually, you know, it's a sharpened aversion that we have, you know, like this is wrong, this is right, that kind of, if it's not filled with ill will, it can give us a sharpness of seeing, well, that person has this skill and they don't have this skill. You know, so it was a kind of a transformed from the ill will of criticizing to the wisdom of seeing the differences between things, seeing the difference between, you know, what somebody's capabilities were and what they weren't, without judging them, but just as, you know, with clarity. So all of those years of unskillful speech eventually transformed, you know, into something really wholesome. And, you know, and it's one of the reasons we say the practice includes every part of us. Every part of us, not everything except this, you know. And because within every part of us that's all caught up and all twisted and all contracted is the seed of freedom. Inside every part of that is the seed of freedom and the seed of something beautiful sprouting. And for myself, I really felt that experientially. And yeah. So the ability to think has allowed us to develop civilizations, you know, crafts, technology, communication. So it's an amazing, amazing thing that we think. And, you know, we wouldn't be in this room right now, in this retreat, if it wasn't that the Buddha really thought about his practice and figured out the best way to teach it. You know, so he didn't do that. That wasn't his awakening and his felt sense of experience. This was like afterwards, just thinking about it, reflecting on, wow, what just happened? you know, how can I convey this amazing thing that happened to other people? You know, and that's how he came up with the path. And that's sort of this really skillful thought. Really skillful thought. When thought isn't filled with the defilements, with greed, hatred, and delusion, thought is a beautiful thing. You know, the organization we have here, the way we communicate, all these things are really come out of wholesome thinking. You know, and thoughts guide us in our meditation. You know, I think most of you have heard a little voice in the back of your head saying, okay, come back to the breath, or, you know, might not use words, but the same idea. You know, we have this little voice, this little help. So even in meditation, at certain times, the thoughts are really useful. I've often used reflection at the beginning of meditation, you know, on a daily basis, you know, not necessarily on retreat, for inspiration. You know, I reflect on something that connects me, that uplifts me. And, you know, one of the things that I've done is, I shared this at the last retreat, is imagine that that my mind is like this, you know, this living room, and the Dalai Lama is coming over to visit. You know, how would I greet the Dalai Lama? You know, and that's what my meditation's like. You know, I'm gonna treat myself the way I would if I had this amazing guest in my brain. You know, and that for me was like, oh, I really want to be. I'd be so happy to see him. You know, I'd be so so glad to be there. I'd listen to everything they said. He said, right? I'd be paying really good attention, and so that would, you know, really connect me sometimes. You know, and I used different things over the years because I would find that sometimes I'd get complacent over time. You know, where I just kind of meditate by, yeah, meditating, you know. and then, you know, it would just lift me and have me look slightly a different way, you know. And, you know, there's so many different ways we use our thinking and ways that are helpful to us. One way to really begin to get to know our thinking more deeply can be thinking of thinking in layers. so that we start from the really coarse, gross layers of the discursive mind to the more refined levels. You know, and the discursive mind is the thinking that's about anything that's not here. You know, so it's the stuff we get lost in, you know. It's like if the memory comes up and, you know, suddenly you're 5 years old thinking about this stuff and, you know, you can spend a lot of time there. Or you have a feeling of, oh, that vacation I went to, and suddenly you're on vacation, you know, and the ocean breeze and all this beautiful scenery and or friends you want to see or other fantasies, you know, or even thinking about food, you know, that's going to be later or different things, anything that's not here. And the thing that's really helpful to notice with the discursive mind in meditation is whether the discursive mind is going on a pleasant trip or a bum trip. And, you know, what I mean by that is like, you know, we can get into the discursive mind. It's like, oh, my childhood was so messed up and I had so much this and so much that and I wish I had been otherwise. And we totally lost in something that makes us pretty unhappy. Or we can also get lost in a discursive mind that actually feels pretty good. Some of those fantasies are a lot of fun, you know. And so it's really good to know what that is. Because when we see the ones that are kind of toxic to us, you know, those are ones we really want to stop them. Because it's very unhealthy for us to continue with these kind of unwholesome discursive thoughts that are filled with ill will towards ourselves or towards other people. Not stop it in a way of pushing it away, but stopping them in a way of not feeding them. You know, like what tends to happen, you know, is the memory comes up of, you know, like for instance, you know, how I embarrassed myself doing something once. You know, and you know, I still cringe at the memory of it, you know, how I did that in public. And it was like, I would cringe. And then my mind would start, you know, kind of throwing some more arrows at it, you know. Yeah, stop doing that, you know. And as I stopped doing that, then I got what was really up. It's like that embarrassment came up, you know, that feeling of being exposed publicly, yuck, you know, it's a terrible feeling. And that feeling came up and I hung with it and I kind of dissipated. And, you know, I brought wholesomeness to it and it wasn't so cringy anymore when I thought of it. It doesn't mean that's always going to happen, but it sure isn't going to get less cringy by poking more arrows at it. You know, with the pleasant discursive mind, you know, people often ask about this, you know, is it okay to daydream, you know, and, you know, in my sense of my own life and my own practice, I find that daydreaming outside of meditation can be really wholesome. It can be a place where, you know, and daydreaming meaning pleasant daydreaming, where you just let the mind roam. You know, you're not really thinking about anything special. You just let it roam. And it tends to free up kind of the creative juices, problem solving. I've often just like gone for a walk where my mind's just like kind of going here and there. And suddenly something I've been working on consciously for a while just shows up. Because the mind's just kind of relaxed and meandering and, you know, and so, but in meditation, you know, I think it's important to remind ourselves, okay, I took this special time on retreat to do this, you know, to really get to know the mind, get to know my heart, train the mind, free the mind. And, you know, I can daydream anytime. You know, having said that, it doesn't mean that I haven't been seduced into it many, many times over the years. I always remember one of Gil's seductions, you know, because he it struck me as just as unusual is that he designed a helicopter, you know, while he was on a long retreat. You know, he spent like, I don't know how long he spent on, I think a couple of days designing this the perfect helicopter, you know. When you're in a 3-month retreat, you know, it's a couple of days is, doesn't seem like that much. I wrote a book, you know. So you know, we, you know, the creative juices are they're really good juices, you know, they're very wholesome, you know, they're just not necessarily the time to use them. You know, so for me, you know, that I just use a very simple not now, not now. You know, so going back to the layers, you know, I mentioned the kind of coarse layer of the discursive mind. And then we go into the next layer, which is a little bit more, a little bit less coarse. And that's the, what I mentioned is like the narrator, the little helper that comes, tells us the, that talks to us about our practice right now, about our life right now. You know, I'm moving my leg, you know, a little closer in. I'm relaxing my shoulders. I'm, you know, those little kind of things that the mind does. I'm bringing my mind back to the breath. And we may not do it with such, with so many words, you know, but it's still the part of our mind that directs us, guides us. Or for some of us, we have narrators, you know, or we have such different minds. It's amazing. Some people have narrators kind of like at the ballpark, you know, they every move, something's going in the background. But as long as it's in the background, it's not a problem. And then, you know, and again, if I start daydreaming, you know, I've said to myself, not now, right? Not now. And so when we say not now, it brings us to the next more refined level of thinking. And this is the type of thinking we do without words. This is the felt sense of experience. And this is where mindfulness lives. And for instance, you know, if I pick up this, you know, pretend it's cold, the cold water bottle, you know, I don't have to think about it to experience it as cold. I don't even have to name it. I don't have to do anything. I just pick it up and I feel the cold. And that's the knowing felt sense. You know, we feel like the little bit of pressure as the air comes into our nostrils. That pressure doesn't need words. We can give them words. But the felt sense doesn't, is much subtler than words. So we actually feel, even if we label, the feeling itself doesn't have words. And so a lot of that quieter way of experiencing, you know, that's the kind of the, one of the most refined parts of thought. You know, one of the things about this kind of mindfulness where we're so connected, you know, as the mind slows down, we can get very, very slow moment-to-moment experience, and you know, thoughts can kind of go away for long periods of time, and we're very, very connected this way. And but that kind of mindfulness also should have its a level of wisdom with it. And an example, you know, I was on a month-long retreat, and you know, I was kind of really deeply concentrated, you know, and it was the end of the day. I went to my room. I went to pick up my bottle of water, take a sip, you know, feeling every movement. Just, it was kind of exquisite, right? You know, every little movement I felt, and everything felt so beautiful. And I take a sip, and it's soap. And you know, so it needs a little wisdom, in other words. And, you know, another example was, you know, I was in a 3-month retreat, you know, and again, people are pretty quiet, you know, and the way the place was set up was that everybody would get in line for lunch. And there'd be this one little doorway where people had to go through, you know, and then they'd get into the main area where they could get their food. And there was this one yogi. And there's something, you know, I don't know if you've heard the term Vipassana romance, when people fall in love with someone they've never met in the hall. Well, there's the opposite. There's a Vipassana vendetta, where you have the same type of feelings towards someone you've never met. Well, there was this guy, and he was like, he walked really slowly, slower than anybody else. Nobody else walked as slow as him. And, you know, he had his cowl, you know, and he was like very spiritual. And he would take 5 minutes crossing that door. And there's 100 people behind him, you know. And I would just, you know, just kind of boil. it was actually a great practice for me, you know, really, really learned. I learned about aversion. I learned about impatience. You know, I learned about desire. it was fantastic, really. It was so interesting, you know, at the end of the retreat, I met him. He's a really nice guy, you know. But we called that very affectionately, and you may, you know, if those of you haven't heard this term before, I'm not sure how proper a term it is, but we call it yogi mind. And I think, you know, like Joanne, who's a kitchen mentor, probably has seen yogis come in there cutting one carrot in 5 minutes. You know, that's called yogi mind. You know, we kind of lose the connection with the wisdom factor, you know. So that always needs to kind of balance this concentration and connection and calm. You know, and it's one more thing about the seduction of thoughts, you know. The mind wants to think, and we really love to think. I mean, this is just something we do naturally. And someone said, you know, we should call ourselves human thoughtlings instead of human beings. You know, because that's what we love to do, you know. And they're so seductive. It's amazing how seductive they are. And sometimes we have to really remind ourselves why we're here. But this fantasy, it's just so, I'm so at peace. There's no pain in the body. I'm just so enjoying this fantasy. Why not? You know, not why you came on retreat, right? And Tenzin Palmo, she's a Buddhist nun that really inspired me. And you know, she spent 12 years in a cave, you know, and so quite an amazing woman. And she said, renunciation of our possessions and people and family and everything, that's easy. it's our cherished thoughts that's really hard. You know, and I love that, you know, because, I mean, you know, the possessions and people, not so easy, you know, but it just shows how, you know, how attached we get to our thoughts. You know, one of the things that that happens is that whatever we think about frequently becomes a disposition of our mind. So, you know, the brain, the more we do anything, the easier it is to do it, right? This is how we learn a skill. You know, if we practice throwing a ball, you know, we do it once, the very first time, you know, not very good at it. But you do it again and again, and the brain actually develops little connections to make it easier and easier to get it right, to get the ball in the right place. And that happens with everything we do. And so, and that goes back to what I was saying about being critical, you know, that if we practice that, we practice aversion, we practice hostility, you know, if that's what we're used to doing, you know, that gets stronger. If we practice being distracted, if we practice being agitated. So every time we practice the opposite, we're strengthening that the wholesome aspect of the mind. Every time we practice being calm, just relaxing. Even though we may not feel that relaxed, but we do relax. And it starts creating the grooves in the brain to make it easier to relax. And so that's the beauty of daily practice. So I know that a lot of people, you know, especially in the beginning, have trouble having a regular practice. You know, going on a retreat is great, you know, but developing that groove of gets easier and easier and easier to show up, to be at ease in ourselves, to be at ease in our bodies, to connect with the felt sense. You know, I remember the first time that I was being told to, you know, well, feel the sensations in your body, you know, and Diana talked about that. I lived in my head, what's the point, you know? And I just felt like I still remember actually the teacher's instructions. So, okay, now feel the buttocks touching the cushion. And, you know, my mind just going, yeah. You know, it's annoyed. It's like, so what? You know, that's not, let me get to the real spiritual stuff, you know, in the head, you know? And, I kind of didn't notice that the practice is body centered. You know, somehow I missed that in the beginning. But slowly, slowly, once I start really feeling the body from within and realizing how that was the source, that was the place to wake up, is in this body. That in this body, we have everything we need to wake up. You know, there's a common saying, you know, from the Buddha, with every drop of water, even a water jug is filled. And, you know, it's moments of mindfulness, you know, like when I first started, showing up in my life, it would be like, okay, so here's a moment of mindfulness. And then I'd spend the next hour doing something else, you know, and not really appreciating, kind of feeling down on myself because I wasn't getting better at it or something, you know, and just not really realizing the power of one moment of showing up, one moment of being here, one moment of relaxing, one moment of knowing, feeling, showing up, and how, you know, that's the whole practice. There is no other moment. There is no other time to do it. And so appreciating, you know, just the stringing together. That's all that the practice does. We string together these moments of showing up, and magic happens when we do that. So some of the things you might pay attention that can be helpful while we're meditating is repetitive patterns in the mind. We each have our dispositions, you know, the things that show up. For myself, I was a compulsive planner, you know, and not that I don't have that tendency anymore. It still kind of lingers there somewhere, but I would feel like I would do it in meditation, you know. I remember my first retreat, at this point in the retreat, the night before last, the night before the retreat's over, I would start planning my packing, you know. What am I going to put where and when? At what time exactly will I start packing, you know? And, none of that was needed. You know, all I had to do is throw everything back in, you know. But that would be like would be going through my head, you know, this planning, this obsessive planning, you know. And I started noticing it, you know, in my mind, it wasn't enjoying it, you know. And it was just this kind of compulsiveness of leaning forward. And, so it's really helpful to see what's underneath that, you know, what kind of anxiety was underneath that, what was I really feeling? You know, and so, you know, beginning to question those things when you see these repetitive patterns. You know, another really common pattern that some people have is worry. You know, oh, what if? What if? What's going to happen? You know, what if? You know, and you know, I always like Mark Twain's quote. You know, some of the worst things in my life never happened. But you know, we can suffer for a lot with these thoughts and fears of things that will that never happen. It's amazing how much. Sometimes, you know, we have obsessive wanting, wanting a relationship. My life will never be okay till I have a relationship, you know, and I need a relationship and da-da-da, you know. And so we have these obsessive patterns that just keep kind of creeping back. And each one of them, again, has the roots of our freedom. You know, we see that, you know, the whole practice is clinging to what we want, is letting go of clinging to what we want and letting go of clinging to push away what we don't want. That's everything. That's the whole practice, not clinging. There isn't anything else. If we're free of clinging, that's freedom. And so in each one of these clingings, right, wanting this, worrying about that, we're trying to control what's uncontrollable. And so there, right there, if we look at it closely, openly enough, that's where the freedom lies. Right in the middle of our suffering, that's where the freedom lies. So being able to meet the ways we suffer and be present enough for them, caring enough, you know, not pushing ourselves, but really doing it with care, with a lot of care, with compassion. Some of this stuff's hard and patient, you know, and that then suffering takes us to the next thing. You know, it takes us to a sense of trust where we can trust ourselves. It takes us to a sense of, you know, faith in ourselves, in the practice, in our lives. And I can't talk about thinking without bringing up one particular repetitive pattern is judgment. You know, and, you know, it's really helpful for me labeling. I don't label much, but I definitely work with labeling judging in my practice because it was so incessant. You know, I always remember Joseph Goldstein saying that he was so fed up with his mind, you know, with all the judging he was doing, that he decided to sit outside the meditation hall. And every time somebody walked out, he started counting his judgments, you know. And I can't remember what number he got up to. I don't remember the story, but it was a pretty high number, you know, before the 45 minutes were up. And so that's a really another common pattern to be aware of. You know, the other thing about, you know, getting to know how we think, getting to know our thinking process and knowing it more deeply, is as the mind gets quiet, we can start really paying attention to how do our thoughts show up in our minds. You know, we've been focusing a lot on the breath, you know, on emotions, physical sensations, you know, but how do our thoughts show up? Some people have a lot of words. Some people have just fragments of sentences. Some people actually come up with full sentences, you know, and some people are very visual. They just see things in like scenes of stuff. And or little pieces of fragments of stuff. Some have a mix of them. Some people have numbers and shapes. You know, shapes are common for some people. You know, and some at different times. And you know, but so notice, you know, when you have thoughts, what are they like? You know, and notice as they come in. You know. One of the special types of thoughts that I talked about in one of our groups today, you know, a number of people, and I have a feeling a lot more of you had a little bit of sleepiness, you know, in the last day. And so they were asking, you know, how do we work with the sleepiness, you know? And one of the things that I work with, is that right before we get sleepy, really sleepy, we start having these nonsensical images or nonsensical thoughts, you know, before we really drift off, you know, you haven't quite fallen asleep, but they definitely don't make sense. And, you know, I call those dreamlets, you know, and for me, like really noticing the dreamlet at that point really sharpens my mind, because it's like, you know, I've got a little separation, I've got a little interest, you know, and, you know, and I might do that 10 times, but still it keeps me from falling over, you know, falling into the sleep. you know, when the mind gets really, really quiet, where, you know, you don't hear words, you don't see images, and it's very, very calm and still, sometimes we even get these little, kind of these little bubbles that want to pop up, and it's like, you know, they're thoughts, but they haven't really formed yet. You know, I sort of think of them as like the pre-verbal thoughts. They're just these little, I just want to think, you know. And it's kind of fascinating to me. You know, and while we're meditating, you know, it's really helpful to really only pay attention to thoughts when they're in the foreground. You know, if they're in the background, just kind of floating by, you know, not being that demanding, you know, you can let them be there. It doesn't hurt anything. You know, as long as the foreground is whatever's up, it's not a problem. We don't have to get rid of that. You know, sometimes the narrator hangs out for a long time. That's fine. It doesn't have to get in the way of our awareness at all. You know, being friendly with our thinking is one of the most important pieces of getting to know our thinking. You know, when we see it in a negative way, like it shouldn't be here, we don't get to know it. You know, this whole practice is about getting to know whatever shows up. You know, not just what we like, but whatever shows up. And you know, if, for instance, if you're a scientist, you know, and there's this amazing new animal, you know, but it's, you know, you kind of view it as kind of gross, you know, and you go, ooh, you know, you're not going to really investigate it, right? You know, so you have to kind of go, wow, this is really interesting, right? And so this is the same thing with our thoughts. If we view them as wrong, you're not really going to look at them. You're not really going to get to know them, get to feel them. You know, you just kind of shove them away into a deep dark corner of our mind. You know, they'll come back up, but, you know, that's what we try to do. You know, and for me, you know, one of the really, really helpful things with working with like frustrating thoughts and thoughts that really annoy me is to be playful with them. And playfulness has been one of the things that, you know, my heart is lifted with play, with humor, with anything like that. It just makes everything so much easier. You know, like, you know, I'd say if only people weren't so annoying, then I'd be enlightened, you know. And so that's one of the helper thoughts. another thing, you know, with thinking, you know, like I've sat down to meditate where, especially in daily life when I have a lot going on, where my mind's just like so busy, just, you know, one after the other after the other. And one of the really helpful things is to kind of open the awareness, make it bigger, and allow ourselves to, what does that actually feel like in the body when the thoughts are moving so fast? How do we actually feel, you know? And sometimes it feels like you've got, you know, little flies around your brain, you know, or little tingling or pressure. And there's all these different physical sensations that happen when we're thinking. And I found that when my mind's that busy, if I go to the body, it's fascinating how interesting the body is. Wow, there's a lot going on here. There's a lot going on here, and it gets interesting. And then as it gets interesting, things start calming, you know. So going to the body with this can be a very useful way if we're feeling overwhelmed by our thinking. One of my favorite images for a really restless mind is the image of wild horses. And you put wild horses in a corral, in a small space, you know, and to me it's like my small little tiny brain, you know, just not much room for wild horses. And you put them in a wide pasture, you know, they're really happy. They're really happy. They're not happy in this little constrained space. And, you know, so I open my field of awareness really huge. And sometimes I've done it through sound, just being aware of the sound out in the world, just allowing the sounds to come in and out. Or I've done it just by focusing on the space around the thoughts. There's always space around our thoughts, you know, outside our thoughts, around our thoughts. So, you know, and that's a, you know, that's been a really helpful way to work with those kind of the intensity of you know, that kind of thinking. And just one more little reminder, you know, giving something attention is like feeding it. It's like food, you know. So whatever shows up, we can feed or we can give it a different kind of nourishment, you know. So it's just that reminder of whatever shows up, how do we treat it? You know, we take like a defilement, a thought of ill will, you know, and what do we feed it with? You know, if we feed it with care, you know, I'm sorry you feel that way, you know, treat it with kindness, you know, and it feeds in one direction. And if it comes up and we go, oh, you bad meditator, it feeds it in the other direction. We add ill will to ill will. So maybe just the last thing I'm going to say is, you know, one of the guidelines in this practice, you know, and, you know, I know when we talk about thinking, I brought up a number of ideas about thinking, and but the guideline is to try to be simple. You know, one of the teachers said, I forget who said that, you know, if it's not simple, it's not vipassana. You know, this practice is actually simple. What's here? What's here right now? So if paying attention to the body sensations, the emotions, the thoughts, if it feels confusing ever, it's always just skillful to just come back to the very simple. The breath is always here, right here. You know, sometimes we're able to open up to all of our experience, and sometimes, no, we just stay really, really close in. This is it right now. You know, one of the classic images in meditation is the image of the muddy pond. And, you know, someone comes along and they stir the bottom of the pond, and all, you know, and all the mud just gets all spread throughout everything. You can't see anything, but you just leave it alone and the mud goes down to the bottom and then you can see clearly. And so often we don't have to do anything. We can just be very simple, just be really simple, and it will settle itself. You know, usually what's happening in our meditation when we're not settled is because we're doing too much. You know, we're chasing things away, we're grabbing other things. But if we just do a little bit less and just be here for what's here, just what's here. Suzuki Roshi said, you know, when you meditate, don't be bothered by your thoughts. So hopefully this talk gave you something to not think about. So thank you.